now to turn to a completely different subject. And this is the contrast is good. That is, amongst evangelical Christians, there's great consensus that we should be preaching the gospel, we should be preaching expositionally. Or last time we were here, there's a pretty good consensus that we should be that we should be seeking revival, and that we should be seeing conversions, we should be seeking the power of the Spirit. What I'm going to talk to you about now, which is City Vision, is not the sort of thing that I think evangelicals have consensus on. In fact, I have occasionally noticed that the kinds of churches that I see thriving in cities don't exactly line up with traditional evangelical or traditional, what we would call in the States, mainline churches or liberal churches. Mainline churches and liberal churches put a lot of emphasis on seeking the peace of the city. They put a great deal of emphasis on the common good, on caring for the needs of the poor, on adding value to and improving the quality of life in a city. Evangelicals, on the other hand, put the emphasis on conversion and evangelism and discipleship. And never the twain meet. They don't meet. The mainline churches don't know how to convert people, so they have fewer and fewer people to actually help the poor. The evangelicals actually only seem to know, once the person's converted, the only thing they seem to know to do with converted people is to try to help them convert more. In other words, just increase the tribe. I'd like to give you a vision, this paper, and also after lunch, for a kind of church that combines those things in an integrative balance. And I don't believe that that is in any way something we have consensus on. So I recognize I could be getting pushback, resistance, and that's all right. Let's talk. That's what we're here to do. So if you take the City Vision paper, I hope you have, I'm going to start a little more than perhaps we would ordinarily do, but because we don't have consensus, we need to go to the Word. And I'd like to start by talking about what is a city in the Bible. The Hebrew word in the Bible is almost always translated city. Is a word that actually, and I've got, this is where people have criticized me, actually, is they see me talk about the city and how the Bible talks about the importance of the city. And I had one time a person come to me and said, you realize that the word city in the Bible is not referring to anything like what we call a city? Because at least in the Old Testament, most of those cities were really just very small fortified settlements. And by the way, it's true. The average city in Old Testament times was 1,000 to 3,000 people. However, on the other hand, and this is important to know, what made a city, and what the word city means in the Old Testament, is a human settlement surrounded by a wall or a fortification. And you and I would think, well, that's what difference that made. It made all the difference. Behind a wall, human society was very different. Outside of the city, when someone killed somebody else, there were no courts. There was no jurisprudence. There was, it was blood feuds. But inside cities, partly because of the density and also because of the safety of being in a city, if someone wronged somebody else, you had elders that sat in the city gate and they decided cases, and cases were decided without, 20 years of blood feud. And so jurisprudence started in cities. Secondly, out in the away from the city, outside of the walls, you basically had subsistence living. People made their own clothes. People made their grew their own food. But inside cities, because they were behind the wall, because you had this great density, you had specialization develop, and you had some people were good at this, some people were good at this, and you had an economy begin. In fact, when you and I think of cities, it's true that we're thinking of large populations, and in the Bible, that's not what made a city a city. What made a city is density of population. So that cities behind walls were very, very, very compact, very, very dense. This is all on the first page if you want to look at it. But the average biblical city even though it was small, it had maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people in it, on the average had 205 people per acre living there. Now, I want you to know Manhattan today, which is the most densely populated part of America, is only 105 people per acre. And, you know, we have 60,000 people per square mile, which is actually more densely populated than London. And that's dense. That's really dense. I'm sure there are cities in other parts of the world besides London and New York where you have that level of density. But it was the density that made a city what it was. It created economy. It created jurisprudence. It created governments. Away from cities, you didn't have civilization. Of course, the word civilization is just the word cityization. And that so when the Bible talks about cities, it's talking about highly developed societies, highly developed civilizations. It's talking about culture. It's talking about art. It's talking about jurisprudence and government. It's talking about the media, as it were, as they had it. It was talking about economics and the economy in ways that those things did not exist outside the city. Here's another way to put it. Even today, and I'm being sketchy at this point. I know this is very top level, but today, what makes a city, even now, is not so much size of population. It's density and therefore the mixture of use. Today, a city is often defined as a mixed-use walkable human settlement. That is to say, if you go out of your door where you live, and within 10 minutes, if you can walk to places to work, places to eat, places to learn, like schools, places to buy and sell or see art, if you can, in other words, if residences, places of learning, places of business where you can work, places of culture shaping, all within a 10-minute walk of where you live, you really do live in a city. Because that's the difference between the rural areas or even the suburban areas. A suburb is a place where you have all the houses over here, all the stores over here, all the places to work over here. They're separate. As somebody once put it, and this is probably on page 2, at the top of page 2, at least on my page 2, human society requires an economic order where people work. Do you see that? Is that the top of your page 2? Okay. Human society is required an economic order where people work and business transactions take place, a cultural order where people learn and read, where scholarship, art, and theater are pursued, a political legal order where cases are decided and governing officials meet. If you think of these elements as elements in a pizza, tomato sauce, cheese, pepperoni, dough, then the city is a place where every neighborhood is a slice of pizza, along with residences and homes. There are places to workshop, places to read, be educated, see art and hear narrative or music, go to worship, watch sport as well. And these are all mixed and compacted together within walking distance. In ancient times, rural areas and even villages could not provide all this because you didn't have enough density of population. So what makes a city is proximity. What makes a city is not size. So there's 2 million population, that's 100,000. It's density, it's proximity, and it's mixed use. And that's the reason why in Old Testament times, especially, a city was a dense place where you had that mixed use, where you had culture forming, and then cities were very, very different than human society away from cities. Now, that's all important for us to understand, because if you don't realize that that's what a city was, then when you read what the Bible says about cities, you won't, I think, read them properly. Now, having said that, modern people, especially modern Christians, do not see cities as particularly important to God or to the Bible. They say, well, you know, I work in cities, you work in suburbs, and it's true, gospel ministry has to go on everywhere. But I'd like to make the case now that the Bible sees cities as important in ministry, as important even in the redemptive work of God, that they had a particular place. I think you can make a really strong case for it, even though I have to say over the last 35 years as a Christian and in ministry, I see very little real good biblical theological work on cities. And I'm not saying that I'm giving it to you. I'm just trying to say I'm trying to give you a start. And here, now if you follow me with, if you can, see where it says the importance of the city in God's plan. Let me Let me just take you through. In one stage, let's stay away from Genesis for a second. I want to stay for a second. When God sends the children of Israel back into Canaan, out of Egypt into Canaan, he commanded that they build cities. They were not allowed to be a strictly agrarian society. He commanded them to build cities. Now, only if you understand the background of what I just told you, what cities were, and why they were so important to the forming of human civilization and culture, would you understand why God would do that. You've heard him, the city of refuge, cities of refuge, right? Well, why were there cities of refuge? Why were cities being built? Because it's in cities of refuge, and only in cities of refuge, and only in cities, that you had jurisprudence, that you had elders to try cases that kept the blood feuds from going on and on and on and on and on. What God was actually saying is he wanted his society to be, to some degree, urban, because he wanted Israel to develop a God-honoring civilization, and cities were crucial to forming civilization. Let me keep on going. When David comes along, God wants David to set up the seat of his government in a city, and he wants Jerusalem to become, as they very famously put in Psalm 48, in the city of our God, his holy mountain is beautiful in elevation and the joy of the whole earth. Something that Alec Matir certainly brings out in his commentary on Isaiah. In fact, Alec Matir says that you could actually call the book of Isaiah the Isaianic literature, he says, could accurately be described as the book of the city. God wanted Jerusalem because cities were the way in which you developed civilization and society. God wanted Jerusalem to be a witness to the world about what a God-honoring society looked like. He wanted the world to see what a society built based on the glory of God and service rather than the glory of man and power looked like. And the only way the world was going to see that is if there was an urban society with the culture, with jurisprudence, with the economics being dominated by the word of the Lord. And that's the reason why Jerusalem was so important. It was supposed to be the joy of the whole earth. It was supposed to be showing the world, an urban society showing the world who God was, the glory of God. It wasn't enough just for Israel in general to be a society. Jerusalem was being held up. According to the book of Isaiah, you can see it. I'm not going to go into detail to try to make this case, but I think if you're familiar with the Old Testament, you see the importance of Jerusalem to the witness to the world of who God is. Now, the thing that is so striking with that as background is what happens when the children of Israel go into exile. And this is page 3. When Israel went into exile, suddenly the people of God's relationship to the city changed. Before that, the city's place in redemptive history was as a way of showing the world through the urban society of Jerusalem what God's glory looked like. However, when they went to Babylon, now what is the relationship to the city supposed to be? Down at the bottom, it's in a footnote on the bottom of page 3. Tremper Longman, in his commentary on Daniel, points out that the purpose of the Babylonian exile was cultural assimilation. The reason why the Babylonians took the cream of the crop, they left a lot of the poor people behind when they did the exile. They took away the professional classes. They took away the artisans and the leaders of government and the nobility, you might say. And they took them to Babylon to make them live in the city. Why? Well, it was a great way of subjugating an unruly group. Because if you took their leaders and you brought them into Babylon after a generation or two, they would become culturally assimilated. You see that, right? You move to another country and you kind of like the country, but you still are like your home country, but then your children grow up and they're a lot like the country you live in. So the purpose of the Babylonian exile was cultural annihilation, cultural assimilation. And therefore, of course, the people who got there, the exiles, were extremely ambivalent about being part of the life of Babylon. But to everybody's shock, God sends a letter, and Hank read the letter to you, In Jeremiah 29, he sends a letter through the prophet Jeremiah to the exiles, and he says, "Here now is how I want you to be a witness to the nations. Here now is how my redemptive plan moves forward. I want you to move into that city. I want you to dwell in that city long term. I want you to settle down. I want you to take part in economic life because I want you to build houses and plant gardens. I want you to raise your children in the city. I don't want you to decrease. I want you to keep your identity as my people, but I want you to seek the good and prosperity of the city, the shalom of the city." Now, this is an amazing statement because Babylon represents, all through the Bible, paganism. It represents the city of man. It represents human pride against God. And it's just astounding for God to say, "Here now is how my redemptive plan is moving forward. You no longer have your own city. You're not in Jerusalem. You're not in charge. But what I want you to do is, as a counterculture, keeping your identity, I want you now to be the very best citizens of this pagan city. I want you to love it. I want you to take care of it. I want you to seek its peace and prosperity. For if it prospers, you prosper." Notice, serving Babylon is not a means to an end. God still considers Babylon under his judgment if you read the rest of chapter 29. And the reason why God says his people should serve Babylon and care for its good, you know, the word shalom there means the peace and prosperity of the city. It means its economic peace and prosperity, its physical peace and prosperity. Okay? But ultimately, it's so that God's people will thrive. And I think this is what this means. They were as much a witness to the glory of God by no longer being in charge, but being a community of people who kept their values and yet served non-believers and cared for the city and took care of the city and lifted it up. They were now a witness to the nations in a new way. Now, here's my question. What condition are we in today? Are we in the condition where we're supposed to be creating Jerusalem? I know you've got this song that you sing about building Jerusalem in the green and pleasant land. I can't remember it. I'm an American. I can't remember it all. But are we really supposed to be trying to turn... Are we supposed to treat London the way David treated Jerusalem? Are we supposed to treat London the way the Jews who were exiles treated Babylon? Not trying to take it over, not expecting that somehow we're going to run everything and make it into an absolutely Christian society, but rather creating a counterculture, keeping our identity and serving the pagan city and thereby being a witness to who God is. Now, I'd like you to, I want to make this case. It's not an open and shut case. People could certainly differ on this. But I think when you get to the New Testament, you see everywhere that we're in the condition of the Jews in Babylon, not the condition of the Jews under David in Jerusalem. Why? Because, and I try to put this down here, this would be on page 4. First of all, we're told, we're called exiles. Peter, 1 Peter 1:1, James 1:1. Now, you know, somebody might, those letters are actually addressed to the exiles in dispersion. Now, somebody might argue that James is talking to Jewish believers, and so maybe, but 1 Peter certainly isn't. And so here are all Christians being called exiles. Not only that, but in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, Peter says, "You're going to be persecuted, but let the pagans see your good deeds so that though they persecute you, they'll glorify God." And Jesus says something very similar in Matthew 5. You know, there's a very interesting place where Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." And then he says, "You're the light of the world." Now, the way John Stott represents that is the salt of the earth means we're supposed to be out there in society being a preservative. That's not a very triumphalistic metaphor, is it? You know, we talked about this actually in November. The other aspect of what Jesus says is you're the light of the world. And in the middle of the light of the world metaphor, he says you're a city on a hill. And then he goes back to the light metaphor. It's actually a little, you know, I know all through my elementary school, I was always told when I'm writing, don't mix your metaphors. But Jesus did it, so it must be all right. Light He says, you're the light of the world. And then he says, you're a city on a hill. And then it says, let your good deeds so shine that the pagans see it. Now, my best understanding of what both what Peter's saying and what Jesus is saying is that we are light in a dark world. We are exiles. We are a city, by the way, in a sense, a kind of counterculture. We're God's city in London City or New York City or whatever city. We are, and the way we show what it means to be the citizens of God's city, the way we show that to the world is by being the very best citizens of London City, of loving them, caring for them, reaching out to them, caring for the good of London. And some pagans, when they see that, are going to glorify God because of that. Now, you might say, no, you just can't apply Jeremiah 29 to us today. You could say that, and a lot of people do, but then I say, okay, well, you tell me. Look, the people of God have only ever been, I know of, in three forms in the Bible. Under Abraham, they were an extended biological family. Under Moses, they were a nation state, in which the king, you know, and the laws punished blasphemy and idolatry by death, and so it was a nation state. And then finally, you have the exile state. And in the exile state, you now have an international fellowship of congregations that now discipline people when they are idolaters, but they don't execute people. You know, no longer are we a nation state. We're an international, multicultural fellowship of congregations. We're a counterculture, but we're no longer a nation state. So I believe that that's the situation that Christians are in now. And therefore, I believe you're supposed to relate to London the way the Jews related to Babylon in Jeremiah 29. And if that's the case, where are we? Now, there's some qualifications, but I'm not going to take the time to go into it. In some ways, we're more like, listen, the Jews in Babylon still were under the Mosaic Code, which meant they couldn't eat all kinds of foods, they couldn't dress in all kinds of ways. The whole purpose behind the Mosaic Code was to make the Jews culturally so different than the people around them that it kept them together. You know, it kept them from assimilation. But we're no longer under the Mosaic Code, so we're actually more involved, in a sense, we're more engaged in our pagan cities than the Jews would have been in Babylon. Also, the Jews were increasing only through biology, and we're going to increase not only through biology, but through evangelism. And so not only do we have in Jeremiah 29 a kind of foreshadow of how we're supposed to relate to our city, which is seeking the peace, but also in Jonah we have a foreshadowing of how we relate to our city, because Jonah was the only prophet in the Old Testament sent to a pagan city to do evangelism, basically, to call them to repent. And if you read Jonah, and at the very end of Jonah, God says to Jonah, who's really, you know, Jonah could not overcome his Old Testament spot in redemptive history. I think Jonah, God was trying to show us and Jonah a new stage that was coming, a stage in which the people of God did not form a nation state and say to everybody else in the world, come and look at how we run our society, but rather a new stage in redemptive history in which mission now is we go out. And we become, we form countercultures in every nation, in every city, everywhere. And we call our cities to believe. And in a way, Jonah just couldn't overcome the place he was in redemptive history. He was sent to this big, wicked, nasty city, Nineveh, to go and to call them to repent. And he really hated them. You know the story. At the very end of the book of Jonah, we have another pro-city statement, in which God looks to Jonah and says, look at Nineveh. There's 120,000 people here who don't know their right hand from their left. Shouldn't you have pity on them? Shouldn't you love them? I do. And it's almost like God is saying, look at this mass of humanity. How could you not love them? I certainly do. So Jonah and Jeremiah are foreshadows, I think, of how Christians are supposed to be relating to their cities. You're supposed to be like Jonah, calling to repentance. And like Jeremiah said, you're supposed to be seeking the peace and shalom of the city. Now, where does that bring us? Let me try to summarize this by... If you look at page 6 and 7, something... See, I know an awful lot of my stuff is out on the internet, and my guess is a lot of you have seen this, but when you get to the New Testament time, you see Paul in the book of Acts... And John Stott points this out in his Bible Speaks Today commentary on Acts. The early Christian missionaries went to cities, and they won cities. And that's the reason why, basically, Christianity triumphed in the Greco-Roman world. Because as cities go, so goes the culture. You know that. If the cities are filled with Christians, but the countryside is pagan, then the culture is going in a Christian direction. If the cities are filled with pagans, and the countryside is filled with Christians, the culture is going in a pagan direction. Why? Because as the city goes, so goes culture. Why? Because I've been telling you. Because that's what cities are. Cities are cultural accumulators. They bring human resources together, and that's the reason the economics first started in cities. It's the reason why jurisprudence first started in cities. Well, now it's everywhere, right? Of course it is. But now cities are still the place in which trends begin. New ideas are birthed, and they flow out to the rest of the society. And so it's still the case, and it was the case by the time that Paul was a missionary, that by going to cities and winning cities, he knew he would win the world. And he did. Having said all that, let me say, here's where I think we should be. Turn to page 14, I hope. And let me give you 5 or 6 principles on city ministry. And we'll end there. I'm not telling you much about how to do it. I'm telling you why it's so important. And why it's important to have a positive view of the city. You see where we are, which is the city and the mission of the church? So if everything I'm saying is right, I hope it is. I can't be sure it is, actually, but I hope it is. Then, number one, if you want to reach the world, you have to reach the city. Why? In general, missions should concentrate more on cities than other places because we're not very good here. Listen, every place in the world I go, you go to China, where Christianity is growing like crazy, out in the rest of the country, in cities they're struggling. They're struggling to reach cities. This is true in Africa. Okay, it's true in Europe. Very often, if you do have pockets of evangelicalism, they usually aren't very strong in cities. And because cities are so important to redemptive history, they always have been, because cities are still so important for the way in which society goes, because it's so complicated to work in cities, generally speaking, they're just poorly served. And so I always try to say to folks, when I say, cities, we need to do mission in cities, we need to do churches in cities, and they say, but what about unreached people groups in the rural areas? And, you know, I never want to pit a soul against a soul. All unsaved souls are unsaved souls, and they need the gospel. And how in the world could you ever say one unsaved group of unsaved souls is more important than any other? I could never do that. I will never do that. But I do know, though, that urban areas are just so underserved by Christians. And it just makes a certain amount of sense to say we need to put our resources where Christians aren't putting their resources. So if you want to reach the city, you need to reach the city to reach the world. Secondly, it's important to reach the city to reach both your region and overseas. Now, what that means is globalization has really changed things. One of the best ways to reach India is to reach London. One of the best ways to reach the Philippines for us is to reach, you know, New York. We had a church in Queens, a friend of ours, a friend of mine, Pete Scazzaro, when he started his church in Queens 20 years ago, he just began winning the people of Queens. And, of course, what you do is when your church grows, you start to plant churches where the people are from. And his first daughter church, he was in Queens, his first daughter church was in Brooklyn. That makes sense. There was people coming from Brooklyn to Queens. And his second daughter church was in Manila. And you say, why? Why not, like, New Jersey? Well, Manila is a lot closer to Queens than New Jersey. That's the way the world is now. There are these incredibly tight ties between these countries over here and this neighborhood in London or this neighborhood in New York, and every city in the world is like that. I hate to bring up Harry Potter, but you know what is it a port key? I thought you touch the thing and it takes you to another place, right? It's automatic. Nobody's enjoying that illustration, I could say. Yeah, cities are filled with these port keys. That is, you you walk into Queens and you touch things and you end up in Manila, because Manila is a lot closer to certain parts of Queens than New Jersey is, because cities are more more connected to other countries than they are to their own hinterlands. And if you want to reach overseas as well as your locale, you should go to cities. So, and by the way, not all cities are the same. I don't want to knock cities, but for example, Phoenix, which is our fifth largest city, has almost no international connections at all. Phoenix is only connected to New Mexico, from what I can tell, as well as Arizona. And yet, Miami, which is smaller than Phoenix, the joke is around America is that the people who read the Washington Post think they lead the country, and the people who read the New York Times wish they ran the country. The people who read the Wall Street Journal actually do run the country, and the people who read the Miami Herald run all the Latin America countries. Because actually the ruling classes of all of Latin America do it from Miami. They're that connected. If you want to reach Latin America, you ought to go to Miami. In other words, if you're thinking of the world now, you got to think about cities. You can't be naive. Next, number three. Third, it's important to reach the city, to reach the culture, to use a New Yorkism. But we already talked about that, all right? If you want to reach the city, if you want to reach the culture, you have to reach cities, because basically globalization and technology means that cities are more influential in the world. What happens in London, what happens in Hollywood, what happens in New York City, what happens in Toronto, these media capitals, has such a huge impact now on even kids in rural Mexico. Kids in rural Mexico know a lot more about, because of MTV and things like that, they're more urban in their sensibilities than their parents are. It's really kind of scary. And therefore, if you want to have any kind of impact on the way the world's going, you've got to go to cities, and you've got to just, Christians have to be strongly represented in the cities. They've got to take the jobs in the media, they've got to take the jobs in publishing, they've got to be here. Number four. Fourth, it's important to reach the whole city to reach the world, which means, as we've seen, there's no part of the city that can be neglected. First, the poor can't be neglected because God's always worked mightily amongst the urban poor. Word and deed ministry will have to be combined because that's what it means to seek the peace of the city. You can't ignore the poor part, the most hurting parts of the city and seek the peace of the city. The church's attitude toward and work toward the poor will be a significant sign of its validity to others. See, our willingness to work with the poor is one of the ways in which the pagans, you know, see our good deeds. Secondly, the immigrants, the nations, the ethne, cannot be neglected because they're more open to and more conscious of their need for gospel ministry when they're here than they were in their home country. You know that. Third, the elites can't be neglected. You know, this is interesting. The people who like to work with the poor, they're really irritated by churches that focus on elites. And the churches that focus on elites very often are very, very negligent of churches that work with the poor. That just can't be. We can't neglect any of these folks because the elites are disproportionately powerful and must be called to use their educational, economic, and cultural power for the service of others. The church in the city has to show its concern for the peace of the whole city. So you have to reach the whole city. And then fifth, it's important to reach the whole city to reach your own heart with the gospel. And I'll just say this. Just real briefly, over and over again, I've had Christians move to the city, and they're just there to use the city to kind of get something on their credentials and then leave. I always try to say, get involved with the people of the city, and you'll see you thought you believed the gospel, and you don't. And they almost always say, yeah, that's right. We have a tendency to not, there's a lot of hard cases in cities, and when you start to see those hard cases converted, there's a lot of people who are very, very different from you. And when you see the gospel transcending cultural barriers, there are all kinds of ways in which people who live in homogeneous parts of the world, homogeneous communities, safe and comfortable communities, they read in their Bible all the things the gospel ought to be doing. And they say, that's nice, I'm sure it's true. But it's in the city you actually see the gospel doing those things. In a way that you'll never, unless you're here, you may never see it. You may never see its power. So you put all that together, you got to do urban ministry. Now, the rest of this handout is talking about actually ways in which you have to make sure your ministry is contextualized to cities. But, you know, if you ask me a question about that, we'll go there. I'm going to, again, rely on the length of the handout to aid my conscience in not covering some things I wanted to cover, but I haven't gotten there. So let's do what we did before, and that is if you have a question, raise your hand. Somebody will hand you. Oh, no, we got something else? Forgive me, Hank. Sure.
Stay here, though. People ask for this format to be changed a little bit. So what we're going to do is going to take 5 minutes, find some people sitting close to you, find consensus on what's controversial, what you agree with, and then come with these points to Tim. So do a little bit of talking amongst yourself, 5 minutes.
Let us let's take some questions. By the way, Hank, I thought it'd be fair to point out something that other folks have pointed out to me in the UK. There's no doubt that the salt imagery of being a preservative in society, surely when he says you're the salt of the earth, it means at least that. But several other people, including Hank, have pointed out that though there's no real total consensus on this, a number of folks have pointed out there may be other ways of thinking about what salt actually did in ancient times. Was salt strictly a preservative? Some folks say no, it was medicine. And I read an article recently on what the role of salt was in ancient society and ancient cultures, which would help us understand Jesus' metaphor more. And I began to realize there's really more to it than just preservative, which means it may be that the imagery might mean more than that. But I just wanted you to, if any of you wondered about that, I want you to know that I am aware that more work needs to be done. Now, questions. Let's go. Who's got some?
How do you answer someone who said to you that, or suggested that your third point in that concluding one, the city and the church, the aim to reach the city, to reach the culture,
right,
seems more like a Christendom endeavor than an exilic endeavor, if we're going to go those kind of models that you described at the start?
If I go back to, in November, I suggested that light and salt do mean some kind of penetration. If you have professionals in your church, in the city, they are going to ask you questions about what does it mean to be a Christian in my work. I think I mentioned this in November when I first, for the first time in my life, when I came to New York. I had mill workers, I had ordinary people, working class people in my church in Hopewell, Virginia, and when I discipled them, I basically discipled them for how they lived on the weekends and during and the evenings. They didn't have a lot of questions about how I did my work because they knew they had to be honest, but that was about it. Work hard and be honest. But professionals in cities came with all these questions like, I'm an actor, what kind of role should I take? As a Christian, I mean, can I tell any kind of story? Only Christian stories? Only stories with happy endings? What do you think about method acting? Was one of the questions, in which case you're supposed to come up with the emotion yourself instead of act like you have anger, get angry. I had business people coming and saying, what is the biblical view of short selling? And people in the financial community said, well, I said, oh, what's short selling? Of course, it means betting a company will do poorly. And I said, oh, that doesn't sound good. Well, but it is good for the economy. And they were really trying to think out how does Christianity affect the way in which I do my work? And I realized if I told them, well, if I actually knew, first of all, I didn't know because I went to theological school where nobody even asked. No, we never talked about that. I never knew how to disciple somebody for their work life. I only knew how to disciple people when they were in my church. And I realized that if I began to disciple them, it was going to change the culture. There would be no way around it. They were going to probably do finances. They would probably do art. They'd probably do things differently than the people in their field. Now, I think that's what salt and light means. It means you live in the culture-shaping spaces and you just be Christians the best you can be. And that is going to keep your culture from becoming the power-hungry, nasty, awful place it's going to be. That's the minimum that salt means. At the very, very least, it means you're having an impact on the culture. You're reaching the culture in some ways. And you know, even John Piper, a friend of mine, not a close friend, but a pretty good friend of mine, who is nervous about talking about cultural engagement. He says, I want to preach the gospel, and he's a little bit nervous about talking about Christians reaching the culture. But I remember recently he said, he began to realize something. He says, it's getting to the place in our culture that because people in the movies they watch, TV they watch, books they read, he says, it's getting to the place where they don't understand what I'm talking about when I'm preaching the gospel. They have no furniture in their minds for it. He says, I began to realize I really need to have Christians just out in the culture, just simply with a Christian idea of understanding of reality, doing advertising, you know, making movies, just so that when I actually preach the gospel, they have some idea what I'm talking about. And he actually began to say, so I would say a modest, chastened understanding of cultural engagement and presence rather than triumphalistically trying to take over the country and make everybody, legislate Christianity. This is an oversimplification, rather than triumphalism of Christendom or the withdrawal of pietism and dualism that sort of says the soul is important and the body is not. Something modest, chastened in the middle is, I think, what goes along with this idea of seeking the peace of the city and being engaged with the city rather than trying to take it over or just withdrawing from it. That's a way oversimplified, but that's the best answer I can come up with. Let's keep going. Do you want to give them down here? Yeah, and over there, second over there. Yes, sir.
How do you relate what you just said about salt and light to Sunday observance?
Well, actually, to Sunday observance, I mean, Christians themselves, I think, need to go to the mat to use Sunday observance to show that we're not going to make an idol out of economic productivity. It's a little bit like gleaning. The idea behind gleaning was you limit your profit-taking so the poor have something. The Sabbath was you limit your profit-taking so you and your family have rest. So I say there's more to it than just making sure that Christians take Sunday off and don't work unnecessarily on Sunday and seek to encourage, for example, Chick-fil-A, which is a fast food chain based on chicken burgers in America, is owned by a good Southern Baptist family, and they never open on Sunday. And that means that they're limiting a lot of, they're losing a lot of revenue. But they believe that their employees love it. Their staff love it. Everybody loves it. They can't believe it. And I think it's a witness. Now, whether it's another thing to say we're going to enforce it with what we call, in the States, we call them blue laws. And blue laws were state laws that made it virtually illegal for anything to be open on a Sunday. Probably that would be maybe a hangover of Christendom. I think it would probably be better for Christians in business to show voluntarily, like Chick-fil-A owners, honoring the Lord's Day rather than probably impose it on people. It really galls people who just don't believe the gospel at all, or don't believe the Bible at all, that they're not able to go out and do things on a Sunday. So I guess this goes along with my answer to the brother over here. Probably I would say I would not as a Christian feel like I should go to the mat and force blue laws on the non-Christian populace now. But I certainly commend, you know, us Christian business owners like Chick-fil-A. They're trying to honor the Lord's Day that way. Over here, yes.
Two questions, if I may. The first is tactless and angry. If I look around where I am in a city, there are poor Christians stay because they have no choice. Rich Christians stay because their money allows them to make the choices they want, such as nice houses and good schools.
Right.
Christians caught in the middle, who don't have as much money as the rich, often leave for bad reasons. How do you help all of those Christians, but particularly the guys in the middle, to stay, to be the city within the city? And second question, it seems easy, in inverted commas, to do multi-ethnic church, full of elites from China, Indonesia, Korea, and Britain, but it seems hard to do multicultural church, elites plus poor. How do you do that?
Oh, well, the first one's an easier question. The second one's a harder one. The first question, we have an elder at my church named Glenn Kleinkenecht, who's lived in the city for years. He's a Campus Crusade city worker. And Glenn, whenever he sees somebody who says, I got to move out because I can't afford to live here in the center anymore, he says exactly what you said. That is, you're assuming that you can't afford it if you can't afford to live in the very, very, very nicest neighborhoods in the whole city. And you're afraid of moving to neighborhoods where the schools aren't as good or maybe it's not quite as safe. And what he does is he tries to encourage Christians to go in groups to certain parts of the city where they can actually make the local school better. I mean, I don't know how it would work here, but I do know that if four or five families went to a local, we call it a public school, a local city school, and actually say as families, we want to make the school a better place. We want our children to come here. We want to make a school a better place. There's all sorts of ways in which he says you can create a pretty good living space, a pretty good place to live if enough Christians are willing to move into an area, band together, watch out for each other, eat together, care about the neighborhood, and do it in a non-paternalistic way. But at the same time, move to a neighborhood that's maybe not as safe or as good. And he says there's not necessarily bad neighborhoods filled with crime, you know, drug deals going down in every corner. He says there's a lot of places in most, in big cities like London and New York, where you can find those seams, we would call them, between the good and the bad areas, that they actually need upstanding citizens. They need people to care. And he believes that most people can stay in the city if they want to, as long as they get rid of this idea that I have to live in the very nice places where all the schools are great, all the food is great, there's no danger, it's just completely beautiful. And he says that, most people can't afford, we have a lot of people that can't afford to live there. You actually need, I think, to become good at orienting those folks. You need to train them. Say, here's how you can live here in the city long term and have a great experience and yet not live in the nicest areas. Your second question, though, is too big to tackle. You're absolutely right that it's not that hard to have a multi-ethnic church if everybody's got a PhD. Ever noticed that? If everybody has a doctorate in the church, we can all look around and say, oh, how wonderful, it's a multi-ethnic church, because usually doctorates come from all over. And yet, you know, the experience of having gotten an academic degree has socialized you so that you're all alike. And you're patting each other on the back for being multi-ethnic when actually you're all the same. You're absolutely right that getting people together across classes, socioeconomic classes, and it's almost like the less education that people have up here, here's your PhDs, your masters, the less education that people have, the bigger the differences between the different racial groups. And so to get a working class multi-ethnic church together is much more difficult. And all I know is there's two or three things you have to do. You have to have a multi-ethnic leadership team. If you want to have black, white, you know, South Asian people in your congregation, they've got to see the faces up front. Makes a huge difference. I think I told you once, maybe did I tell you this? In the very beginning of Redeemer, there's only two people up front. There was a Chinese woman who played the piano, and the piano was right here, and there was me. And after about 6 months, I looked out there and I saw nothing but white and Asian faces. And I wasn't even trying to reach Asians, but I wasn't trying to reach anybody. I mean, I wasn't smart enough to even think about it. I didn't know how to look at a city and break it down like that. But I suddenly realized because they saw a white and Asian face, they felt welcome. They felt welcome because they saw themselves up front. And that's the very, very beginning. You have to have a team of people who is multi-ethnic, who's leading. They don't all have to be full-time staff people, but you have to have a multi-ethnic leadership team. And the people need to see themselves, you might say, up front and empowered. And they also have to see the people being able to work together and love each other. and then it starts to happen in the congregation. Now that's, I do not want you to think, because I want another question or two here, so I'm going to stop. But I don't want you to think that that's all there is to it at all. But I think that's always the very, very first thing, and it's very, very difficult to without that. But the other thing I want you to realize is there's a limit to how diverse any church can be. There's a limit to how much you can take. And we have found, for example, a black-led multi-ethnic church in New York, or an Asian-led multi-ethnic church, or a white-led multi-ethnic. When I say led, I mean the main preacher. May have all the same people. I mean, they may represent the different groups, but every one of them is like a stew with the same three or four ingredients, but with each one has a little bit more of that ingredient. You know, in other words, because Redeemer is led by a white man, and there's to some degree, I can't transcend that. There's a white sensibility. To no degree can I transcend that. There's a white sensibility. Well, no, here's the difference. Here's the difference. Recently, I talked to a person, a non-white member of my staff, and what he said to me was interesting. He says, I can handle answering the white person as long as you continually surprise me. In other words, when every so often you say something that makes me say, huh, it's interesting that a white person would know that. That's good. In other words, as long as you surprise me as being much less clueless than most white people, that's okay then, that's fine. He says, when I have a white person who's as clueless as all other white people about what it's like to be not white, he says, then I just feel like I can't take it here. And so it's possible to be white and lead a multi-ethnic group like that, and yet there's a limit because it's fused with a white sensibility. If you have an Asian person leading a multi-ethnic group, it's more infused with Asian sensibility, and it'll be a little more dominant Asian, but you'll have white people. So what you really probably need in a city are multi-ethnic churches, but they will not all look alike. They'll all have slightly different brackets. You know, in other words, here's a person, because it's white-led, will be multi-ethnic, but have a fair amount of white sensibility. Here's a person who's, because you say, South Asian-led, and hopefully that's going to be multi-ethnic, but it'll really reach a different bracket. So if you think of the whole spectrum of people, you can never expect to get more. You're trying to make your church as wide as possible in appeal, but there's a limit, and you shouldn't beat yourself up too much about the fact you can only have so much of a spread. I think we have time for one more question. Yes, okay.
British evangelicals have got a strong history of supporting overseas missionary work.
Yes.
We can give our money, we can pray, but someone else is doing it and it's over there.
Right.
Would you say something helpful about identifying and investing in the mission opportunities right on our doorstep in the city?
I can tell you the difficulty with getting people to really invest heavily in mission opportunities right here. One of the problems you might have if you're the missionary trying to raise the funds is you may paint your mission field, your city, in such dark, horrible colors because that's the way to get people to treat you as a real missionary, even though you're in London and not in, you know, Mumbai or Sao Paulo. I mean, I've had many people tell me that I got lots of support when I was overseas, and as soon as I moved back to work in New York City, everybody said, oh, you're in America now, so they figure you don't need our money. Well, if you're working in New York, you have no more, you're working with people who can't support you. I mean, you're working with unbelievers, you're working with poor people, and they can't support you. It's not like a church in a suburb. And so they ought to support you, but, well, the problem then is that they see you back here, and therefore you're not going to get our money anymore. So what you do to counter that is you talk about how awful it is here in London, and it's just awful, and the people, there's blood running in the streets, and the people don't know Jesus, and it's just very dark, and it's dangerous, and I fear for my life every time I get on the tube. And of course, none of that's true, really. And yet you paint it as this horrible place, so they'll give you money. Be careful about that. The only way to do it is to do something like what I try to do here. You have to give people information. You have to say, let me tell you the reality of the importance of the city. Let me tell you who I'm working with. And you just have to be above board and make the appeal that city workers need the support of the church. And you could also make the case that cities now, the world's in the cities. You know, you can make, there's a lot of great stories. The story I tell about the fastest way to Manila is through Queens. And if you really want to reach people in the Philippines, you know, support city workers in Queens, in these particular parts of New York. So you need to give them information and be careful. But we do need to appeal to our churches to support ministry in cities and to know that it's going to take a longer time, for, if ever, to get self-supporting. And in many cases, it needs to be supported the way missionaries overseas are supported. Just be aware of that temptation. And I'm not, I don't mean to pick on anybody. I just know that I do it myself. I go out to people to raise money, and there's always a danger of painting your city in dark colors in order to get people to come to it, in order to get people to give. We can get people to give if you just tell them the facts. I think I'm going to have Hank tell you what's happening next.